Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It's Monday, October 7th, 2013. I want to dedicate today's news and comment to my next-door neighbor, Jim Cowperthwaite, who passed away last week at the ripe old age of 90. Well, we thought the government was shut down, but the Pentagon got a special break, and Congress passed and the president signed a bill continuing their funding. That allowed the Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel to unfurlough all of the civilian employees of the Defense Department, and for them, I'm happy. But it also permitted two strikes to take place. These were commando raids in far corners, well away from the United States, and well outside any zone of combat where we are authorized to operate. First, we took a raid in Tripoli, Libya, and it's reported that we grabbed Nazi Abdul Hamid al-Rukai, better known as Abu Anas al-Libi, from outside his home in Tripoli. He currently is occupying a suite on a Navy ship in the Mediterranean, where he is likely being intensely interrogated. Are they using torture methods? I don't know. But one interesting question, and these two raids raise more questions than they answer, like so many of our activities, we decided to capture al-Libi and not just hit him with a drone strike. That's different. And I'd like to know the rationale for that. I don't approve of the kidnapping of this man, and I, you know, on territory where we have no legal authority to be. Libya is a broken nation, and we helped break it. But that doesn't mean that we can enter its territory at will, grab a suspect, and just have our way. And get this. Lori Price at Citizens for Legitimate Government, she has quite a memory. And she reports that we already captured Abu Anas al-Libi in January of 2002 in eastern Afghanistan. I'd like to hear that sorted out. The other raid took place in lawless Somalia, another broken nation where the U.S. has no legitimate right to a military presence, even as temporary. As a Navy SEAL Team 6 raid, maybe it was another SEAL team, I don't know, but it was Navy SEALs, who went ashore on Saturday morning, American time, and attempted to grab a leader of Al-Shabaab. We're told this is a response to the brutal attack that killed dozens of people and injured others in the hundreds at the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenya. But I don't know of any treaty that we have with Kenya that says that we will help defend you from a group called Al-Shabaab. Our own State Department, as recently as 2 months ago, said Al-Shabaab had nothing beyond regional aspirations. But in the American media, we tie Al-Shabaab to Al-Qaeda, and then carte blanche, right? We got to get Al-Qaeda. We got to snuff him out. We were told that Al-Qaeda had been decimated, was on the run, reduced to a handful of people. But when it's convenient, that threat is inflated, like a Michelin man, and it's back in our faces. And I'm reading an account of these two raids in the New York Times, written by David Sanger, the chief Washington writer, and Peter Baker. And they don't even hint at any question about whether this was legitimate on the part of the United States, or what line of authority was tapped for the president to make these decisions. Again, I think it's interesting that we didn't use drones. Maybe we were hoping to capture this fellow in Somalia, the Al-Shabaab leader. But the Navy SEALs met so much resistance that they turned back and did not attempt to capture this Al-Shabaab leader. So once again, we see America flex its military might and muscle in ways that are most likely to produce more blowback against the United States in the future. And I remember vividly Obama, in one of the debates with McCain back in 2008, said he wanted to change the mindset that led to our quagmires in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I would have to argue that today, Barack Obama is deeply captive to that mindset. Sybil Edmonds broke a big one over the weekend based on some courtroom activity in the Washington, D.C. area. She has pieced together interesting information that suggests that Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen Muslim cleric who we killed in Yemen using drones, may have been an asset for a government agency of the United States. Now, when this murky phrase, some other agency or an unnamed agency of the government, is used, it's almost always the CIA. And this comes from a case where Ali al-Tamimi, a Virginia man who's serving a life sentence for supporting jihad against the United States, is being defended by Jonathan Turley, the very able and brilliant legal scholar who teaches law at George Washington University. And Turley, according to Sybil Edmonds, has accessed recently released FBI files that suggest Awlaki may have been acting as an asset for some government agency. And the judge in the case, Leonie Brinkema, is holding tight to the government's demands for secrecy. She says Mr. Turley has no right to know whether the government had an asset into Awlaki. This would be about the time we killed him. And further, Mr. Turley has no right to know if Mr. Awlaki was an asset at that time. Now, these statements, once again, invite more questions. And as you know, if you're a regular listener here, I have questioned the case against Awlaki all along. If he was such an enemy of the United States, why didn't they make the evidence public, even if they decided to wait until after he was killed by the drone strike? And we deserve to know. This is a really crucial issue. Obama crossed a constitutional red line, if you'll forgive the expression, when he made that decision to kill the senior Awlaki. And they say it was an accident that his 16-year-old son was killed 10 days later. But if these issues were aired and the American public had the information they claim is there to justify this, I might have a different view. But they won't, and so I don't. And I'm grateful to the people who put up with my views and not only listen, but support me financially through subscriptions at peterbcollins.com. Thanks to Jens Nielsen, who just signed up for a new subscription today. Thanks, Jens. Kathleen Emmer is back, paying much more than she has to. She does it voluntarily. Thanks, Kathleen. Susan Gavet and Janet Price also support me with their monthly subscriptions. Would you like to join them? I wish you would. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Right in the upper left-hand corner, under my picture, follow the links to sign up. The options, $1 for a 24-hour pass, $5 a month, you can cancel anytime, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And if you're a new annual subscriber, our new bonus book is Heidi Bogosian's Spying on Democracy. You got to act fast, though. I have a limited number of copies of that book, and it's for new subscribers. I can also bonus you a bag of Kona coffee, the kick-ass kind of Kona coffee they grow on the Big Island of Hawaii. The other way you can support us is by steering your web business to GoDaddy.com. I've been doing business with them for more than 10 years. They have great customer service. And right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rates start at just $1.99 a month. You'll get your domain name free, too. To get a screaming deal that benefits the Peter B. Collins podcast, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this very podcast at peterbcollins.com. Well, we're bobbing and weaving. I have kind of whiplash over what our intentions are regarding the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I am stunned at the silence in the United States of citizens, of our elected leaders, pundits. Nobody talks about Afghanistan. We still have some 60,000 troops there, and maybe as many as 100,000 contractors. And for whatever reasons, the American denial, just pushing it out of our minds and off the radar, is something I have never seen before. So we're now threatening the zero option again, trying to get Afghanistan to comply with American demands by threatening to turn around and pull all of our troops out and just leave them in the lurch. And of course, Afghanistan is not self-sustainable. They don't generate enough government revenue to keep that government afloat for the next 20 minutes without American subsidies. And yet Karzai, who is planning to run elections next year and retire to a huge villa that is being refurbished right next to the presidential palace where he lives in Kabul now, he's kind of like Pope Benedict. He's planning to step into the background but maintain a presence and probably some influence over the next government in Afghanistan. I want the zero option. I think that it's going to be messy when we leave. There is no question about it. Look at Iraq. It's a huge mess. People are dying, you know, 30 people a day on average now. The civil war that we suppressed has broken out big time in Iraq. Afghanistan is a different composition of the warlords and the ethnic groups. But it's a place that is generally ungovernable, and we have no good options here. And I think the zero option is the cleanest, just to get us the hell out of there, and we'll see what happens. The New York Times, in a front-page Sunday article, and I want to credit Mike McIntyre and Cheryl Gay Stolberg, they give us the recent history of the government shutdown, a crisis months in the planning. And what I didn't know is that old Ed Meese is a driver of this current government shutdown. He was a loyalist of Ronald Reagan, served as attorney general, had his own personal war on porn, so he was allowed to look at porn. A real strange man. But we see now that this budget shutdown and the attempt to make Obamacare the focus is part of the long arc of the so-called Reagan Revolution, fueled by money from the Koch brothers, spread around through Americans for Prosperity, Freedom Works, the Heritage Foundation, where former Senator Jim DeMint is installed now. And have you seen that really disgusting ad? They got $5 million out of the Koch brothers and Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce. They spent a total of $200 million over the past year, but $5 million was set aside for these ugly ads where an Uncle Sam puppet or doll pops up between the legs of a woman who's having a gynecological exam. You know, she's up on the table, her feet are in the stirrups, and the nurse or doctor leaves, and suddenly Uncle Sam is popping up between her legs. That's the image that the right-wing Tea Party billionaire-funded lobby is promoting. And it's sick and disgusting and offensive in and of itself. But they seem oblivious to what they have done, which is to put Uncle Sam between a woman's legs when it comes to abortion rights, when it comes to contraception rights. The simple act of having a birth control pill or other device has now been sharply restricted by the same people who want you to believe that Obamacare puts Uncle Sam between a woman's legs. I just find it bizarre and incoherent. I guess it means, you know, it makes sense to a right-wing Bible thumper, and I hope non-right-wing Bible thumpers will forgive me for that generalization. So the Koch brothers at Americans for Prosperity, they've funneled $5.5 million into anti-Obamacare ads over the last few months. There's this effort funded through Charles Koch and the FreedomWorks campus effort called Burn Your Obamacare Card. They don't even have a card to burn. You have to make one up and then burn it. It's not like a draft card or a Social Security card that, you know, many people were issued. There is no Obamacare card. I mean, these people are so detached from reality, it's scary. Also pumping money into Young Americans for Liberty. And they are harassing Republicans who don't want to jump on the train that's going over the cliff with Ted Cruz and John Boehner at the controls. A couple more items from this article. There is Freedom Partners, a tax-exempt business league that claims to have more than 200 members, each of whom pay dues of $100,000. The group's board is headed by a longtime executive of Koch Industries. Yes, they know what's best for America, and they're trying to buy it. Now, I want to be fair here. The Times, in this lengthy piece, it takes up a full page inside the paper. They bury in the middle this paragraph. In the fight to shape public opinion, conservatives face well-organized liberal foes. Enroll America, a nonprofit group allied with the Obama White House, is waging a campaign to persuade millions of uninsured to buy coverage. The law's supporters are also getting huge assistance from the insurance industry, which is expected to spend $1 billion on advertising to help sell its plans on the exchanges. So, the right-wing, billionaire-funded Tea Party groups feel that they are outgunned. They're David to the government's Goliath. Now, the insurance companies are going to spend $1 billion because they're going to make billions more. And this has been my problem with Obamacare to begin with, is that it makes us all captive to the for-profit insurance industry in this country. And it is fair to note that, you know, that information is going to be pushed out, and people who don't support it, you know, arguably have the right to oppose it. But they're not doing it in a way that is honorable or respectable, because I think they don't know what those words mean. We're learning more about the two people described as lunatics who recently were shot and killed in Washington, D.C. Alexis, the guy who was described as the Navy Yard shooter. Well, his employer, a company called The Experts, knew all about his mental problems. And they recap here in this story the incident in Norfolk, Virginia, August 4th, and then a week later, or just a few days later, in Newport, Rhode Island. The guy's mother told the director of The Experts that her son's paranoia tended to subside with time, but he likely needs to see a therapist. So they knew all about this guy, and the contractor that did the security clearance that allowed him to continue to work and gain access to the Navy Yard. Well, they've walked away with billions in government contracts, and it's been exposed that at the end of a quarter, they don't care how far along a security investigation is. It's got to be wrapped up so that they can bill for it. And we're learning more about Miriam Carey, described as deeply depressed following postpartum depression, or due to postpartum depression, and her one-year-old child was in the car that she rammed into a barricade at the White House and then went on a high-speed chase with Secret Security and Washington cops following her, wound up at Capitol Hill last Thursday afternoon, where she was shot and killed in her car. And as I've said, she clearly provoked this. I don't know what drove her to do it, but they didn't have to kill her. They could have shot up the car. There are many other, you know, non-lethal means that they could have used to protect officers. There were two either Secret Service or cops who were injured in this whole melee is she was using her car in a way that can be described as a weapon. But still, the bottom line is she did not have to die. My friend Steve Horn got a mention in the New York Times and Joe Nocera's column over the weekend. Joe, who describes himself as a supporter of fracking, talks about the recent report that sharply reduces estimated leakage of methane from fracked wells. And this is one of the side effects of fracking that Steve Horn at DSmog Blog has written about so effectively. And Horn is the one who coined the term frackademia for the way that academic institutions have been bought off to provide phony science in support of fracking. And so when this study came out, which unbelievably reports very low levels of methane leakage, Nocera writes, the anti-frackers quickly dismissed the validity of the study because the nine companies involved had both cooperated and helped pay for it. Steve Horn, a climate change blogger, dismissed the study as frackademia, industry-funded science, in air quotes, dressed up to look like objective academic analysis. The question of why a study that necessitated industry cooperation and money is inherently less valid than a study proposed by scientists who are openly opposed to fracking was left unanswered. Well, Nocera is entitled to his opinion and his argument. But he is even skeptical of this new study, which shows this dramatic drop in methane leakage. And I'll give Nocera credit for being honest in the face of his own bias. Coverage here in the newspapers in California of the 10-year anniversary of the recall that deposed Governor Gray Davis in the first year of his second term in office. And you remember who replaced him, right? We are unable to forget here in California.
Who can take California? Who can take California? Set it on its ear.
Set it on its ear.
Stop it in its tracks and take it out of gear. The girly man.
The girly man.
The girly man can.
The girly man can.
The girly man can.
The San Francisco Chronicle published two, not opposing views, but slightly contrasting views about the legacy of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Put it all askew.
Who won the recall simply because Gray Davis was unpopular and everybody knew who Arnold was.
The girly man.
The girly man can.
But I want to particularly take to task Susan Kennedy. She's an interesting woman. She's an out lesbian, and she served as the essentially chief of staff to both Gray Davis and to the guy who deposed him or replaced him. And she wrote in her piece in the Chronicle that, he forced the legislature to retract some of the measures that had so enraged people, the hated car tax. Now, the car tax was unpopular, but it was because when Gray Davis reduced the car tax back around 1999, he knew that someday we may need that money back in the Treasury. And so they were too clever, and they wrote the law so that if certain triggers occurred, that the car tax would just go up by itself, and the legislature wouldn't have to approve that, the governor wouldn't have his fingerprints directly on it. And when that happened, people did get pissed. But it was so irresponsible and such a grandstanding move for Arnold Schwarzenegger on his first day in office to, with a flourish, sign a repeal of the increase in the car tax. That was the step that led California to 5 years of, you know, double-digit billion-dollar deficits. By many accounts, the car tax cut alone cost California more than $35 billion over the 5 years of real red ink here. And nobody mentions that, not in these little retrospectives about Governor Schwarzenegger. You may also recall that the city of Bell, which is near Los Angeles, was the scene of a great fleecing. And city manager Bob Rizzo the former city manager, was paying himself $800,000 a year. And the police chief was getting $200,000 or $300,000. I mean, it was just a feeding frenzy. And we were expecting on Friday the announcement that Robert Rizzo was going to prison for at least 10 years for the fraud, mismanagement, and just fleecing of this little town called Bell. But there appears to be some sort of a backroom deal. Judge Kathleen Kennedy is being accused by the attorney for a defendant that she, he's a district attorney, I think, for improperly injecting herself into the case by brokering a plea deal with the former city manager. And he's been, instead of 10 to 12 years, it appears that he was allowed to plead no contest, and his sentencing is being delayed so that he can testify against others who were at the trough with him. We're going to watch this one because it stinks. And I don't know what forces are at play there. Well, the Supreme Court has an interesting docket. And despite the government shutdown, the justices took the bench this morning and announced some of the cases that they're dismissing and some that will be heard. One of the most important ones, the oral arguments are on Monday, which would throw out the overall contribution limits on the ultra-wealthy. And it's likely that based on Citizens United, the court is sympathetic to that case. But the good news is that Ken Cuccinelli, a rabid right-wing nut who is running for governor of Virginia and who's been promoting his candidacy with a really ill-conceived law against sodomy and oral sex. Well, Cuccinelli has been making a big deal that he has appealed this to the Supreme Court, and they dismissed it with no comment. They do occasionally have good judgment. And speaking of sodomy and sodomites, Larry Craig is back in the news. Do you remember the former senator from Idaho? He was accused of trying to get it on with a guy at the airport in Minneapolis in a bathroom. Well, federal election regulators want Larry Craig to pay $140,000 in fines and return nearly $217,000 to his campaign, arguing that he misused the money to fund his legal defense. Well, Larry, it gives me an opportunity to trot this beauty out one more time. Have a good day, and thanks for listening.
This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman.
Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman.
Most people go to the airport bathroom to relieve themselves before their next flight. But not you. No. You're looking to become a member of the Ground Level Club.
Not what they mean by a layover.
You, Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman, voted against gay marriage. That's because you want to have as many partners as you can, in as many cans as you can.
A romantic toilet rendezvous.
Come on, sir. You are gay, aren't you?
That's not what I said on C-SPAN, no.
So the next time you're in the airport lavatory stall and see a polished wingtip tap, tap, tapping to make your acquaintance, run away, or you might be the belle of the bathroom ball with Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman, a real American hero.
Mr. Closeted Conservative Congressman.